Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. And along with John, KC2 WGB, John and Dick, I try to run this thing called the Technical Med. Usually a pretty enthusiastic crew of guys sign in at this time to ask their questions and comment. The Technical Med's major purpose is education. We try to tap into all of that brain power that exists in the tri-state area. Now by way of internet and IRLP, we get check-ins quite often from areas even further outside of the tri-state area. Major purpose of the TechNet is to answer questions that ham radio operators ask each other. Ham radio operators are pretty curious people. I think to some degree there's a scientist locked inside of many of them. They want to know what Mother Nature is really saying and how does all this stuff work, antennas and transmission lines and propagation and receivers and frequency synthesizers and satellites. There's 26 different kinds of ham radio. FM 2-meter ham radio, the one you're listening to right now, is just one of the 26 kinds. And if for some reason that one doesn't please you, before you give up on this extremely educational hobby, try one of the other 25 hobbies, one of the other 25 versions of ham radio. Let me drop. From my point of view, the schools of electrical engineering do a only mediocre job of teaching wireless technology, how radio transmitters, receivers, and all that wireless equipment, how does it all work? From my point of view, the schools, most of the respected schools, do a mediocre job of teaching that. I can tell because as I interview those students when they come out of those schools, their understanding of the subject is less than I think it should be. It hasn't been explained to them in a way where they can walk out of a classroom whistling that tune, if you know what I mean. A computer scientist loads an awful, and when he comes out of a good school, he knows an awful lot about that profession. But when it comes to radio knowledge, up till now, the only way a guy gets that is through 10 years of apprenticeship or having been a ham radio operator. You really want a wireless engineer at your company? Most of the time, you've got to hire a ham if you want that, whether it be a broadcast or companies that are making transmitters and receivers and things like that, radio frequency identification circuits and so on. So this is where it's coming from. This is the source of an awful lot of that radio communication knowledge from my point of view. What we try to do, John and I, is to take the people who sign in during the first hour in the order in which they sign in. Let me drop. During the first hour, we take those people and try to give them at least a brief answer to that question. So in theory, a person doesn't have to wait longer than the first hour, 8 to 9 o'clock. The TechNet does last for 4 hours, usually, from 8 o'clock till midnight. The total number of hours of the TechNet and the total number of men have existed over the last 30 and a half years. This is TechNet number 1,440. Lots and lots of information has passed over that time, and you can review the last 6.5 years of this information by going to a website called amateurradio.tangovictor, www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Mike Perry, KC2NJI, has been gathering that information in that manner for lots of years now. As I said, we try to answer everyone's questions during the first hour. After that, John goes to the mailbag, meaning that people who send him questions by way of internet or snail mail because they don't yet have a ham radio license. The real TechNet question and answer information is a live show of questions and answers. John and I are not promising to run a free-of-charge consulting network by way of the internet or by writing. That would be way beyond the call of duty. Let me drop. At the end of that hour, when at the end of the mailbag, which lasts about a half hour or so, Paul, WS2N, will tell us what's been going on with National Aeronautics and Space Administration. He didn't get a chance to tell us what was going on last week, and I know he's got information to give us this week about space and about the comet that's now viewable and things like that. And after that hour and a half or 2 hours, we then quite often get into the deeper subjects. Glenn, KC2, Q and I have had a on the air, running discussion of what we think is really a radio wave in free space. The way it's taught in the books, the way it's described in the equations, the information is given to us in the electrical engineering courses we've taken, where they give you the course on Maxwell's equations and electromagnetic theory. I think there's missing information there. I think the understanding we're getting there is less than real. Very similar to for 100 years we have been teaching all of our pilots where does the lift of a wing come from, and if you want to pass that course you have to say the words Bernoulli's principle. There's a lot of new information been gathered over the last few years, last decade in fact. It's getting stronger and stronger, showing that Bernoulli's principle is not where the lift of the wing is coming from. And that difference is not just academic. Pilots who have that misunderstanding of where the truth really is sometimes die, sometimes kill their passengers indirectly, if you know what I mean. That's what happened with Flight 587, in my opinion. So seeking the real truth has its advantages. You'll never know how you're going to be applying that information downrange, but guarantee there will be a way. Okay, let me try you one more time. The person signs into the TechNet by giving John and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in just because you're listening. After 30 years of TechNet, more hours of TechNet than Johnny Carson has spent on the air with The Tonight Show, after 30 years and all of those hours, by now we believe that someone is listening. We don't have to have that convinced to us anymore, proven to us anymore. So as long as you've got a real question or comment, please give us your call letters and name. A typical sign-in would sound like this, KD2BHY, Jim, and yes. So do we have any check-ins? Give me your call letters and name right now, KQRIW.
W-H-Y-Y, Joe, yes.
KD2BHY, Jim, and yes.
H2MNY, Ray, and yes.
WS2N, Paul, with a space report.
Okay, that was a good one. We got Joe, Jim, Ray, and Paul. Another call. Anyone else got any, want to give me the caller's name because they do have a question or comment? Give it to me right now, K2LAW. We've got more than enough to get going. So, Joe, the P2RYY, how have I used to say electrons, well, in space there are no electrons of a radio wave, but I'm slowly beginning to believe. But other than that, how are those electrons treating you this week, Joe? The P2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, they've been good. Very, very good. Okay, here's the question. I'm going to try to reconstruct my dipole for 80 meters that I was using originally. Copper-clad copper well, which I think is a fairly thin strong wire. The problem is it flexes too much and breaks. So I'm going to go over to a much bigger wire, stranded 14-gauge wire. But I'd like to do something a little different this time. I'd like to make a partial fan dipole and try to put 80 meters or 40 meters off one constructed, off one ballot, off one line. The island for the ballot is not very big. And I don't know if I could probably get two of them in there easily, but if I want to add even another dipole later on to possibly cover 20, I don't know if I can get three of them in there at once. I thought of using something like a stainless steel bolt through the eyelet on each side, but my big problem where the question comes from, using standard type of solder lugs connected to the antenna wire, those kind of lugs will fatigue if you bend them back and forth. Any idea of what I can use in place of that, which might be better suited for that type of application? Back to you.
Do you have the ability to get a hold of a larger egg insulator, a homebrew one? You probably think that there's some critical requirement that the two holes that are where the wire is going to go through for the actual dipole have to be close together, and they don't. You could have a ridiculously large spacing between the two, and to use a big enough egg insulator, Joe, you'd have no trouble getting all of the wires in there and then some. So maybe you've got a favorite egg insulator. Maybe it's got a doodad off to one side that mechanically supports the transmission line and brings it off at right angles and has another hook that goes onto the support structure. So must you use that particular egg insulator is question number one. Answer number two, yes, don't use solder lugs and things like that that are going to fatigue. If there's enough hole space for one of your massive pieces of 14-gauge stranded wire, and you don't have enough hole space for the other, and you can't expand that hole by some convenient technique, as long as the first wire that you're going through the hole you think is strong enough, there's nothing wrong with stringing the 40-meter dipole, so to speak, a couple of inches downrange on the 80-meter dipole. I know that this sounds like it's going to violate your common sense. You would like to think that the wire for the 80-meter dipole is pure and doesn't touch anything for 40-meter and vice versa. Don't worry. If you went a foot downrange on the 80-meter dipole and then twisted on with some kind of a fancy knot so it doesn't slide or solder the 40-meter wire at that point, believe it or not, it would still do exactly what you want to do. Let me drop it. You've got a hell of a lot of choices here, as you can tell, and an awful lot of what your common sense would tell you is a pure situation. You think you're contaminating it if you do what I'm talking about. Not to worry. That 40-meter dipole will present the right impedance only when a 7 and a fraction megacycle signal is going there, and the 3 and a fraction megacycle signal will see that as a pure open circuit, and even though it's hanging a foot downrange on the 80-meter dipole, it'll have an amount of perturbation that you can't even measure, and vice versa. So you've got lots of choices here, as I see it. Mechanical choices, electronic choices, and sliding one set of wires downrange from another. And you'll still get full fan dipole operation. The magic of a fan dipole is it automatically does switching. You don't need a relay in there to flip between the 80 and the 40-meter dipole, depending on which band you're on. Electronically, that happens automatically. It's almost as good as if you had a real set of cavities as bandpass filters there, passing the right frequency to the right dipole. Mother Nature does that for you all automatically, Joe. Maybe some of that helps a little. WA2RYY. And when you do this, let us know how well it works. K2RYW in the deck, man.
Okay, well, another one along the same line of the dipole, the fan dipole. What kind of spacing would you recommend as far as the minimal spacing going out at the end of the 40-meter end of the dipole? Because that's going to be, say, 33-something feet from the balance, approximately. How far would you say, at a minimum distance, that be hanging below the 80-meter dipole and so forth? And again, if you made 20 meters, that would be half the distance you mentioned again. How far would you say that has to be below the end of the 40-meter dipole to provide some sort of minimum amount of spacing? I mean, I don't think you can just have these things all almost going to the same point and be supported in, from the same physical point at a given distance away, or am I wrong on that?
John, good question, Joe. And believe it or not, there's a yes and a no answer to this one. There was a guy who had an article in QST magazine a zillion years ago in which he took the ribbon cable that is used for powering a ham M rotator, which I think has got 8 leads to it. And whether or not he used all 8, I'm not sure. By cutting back various portions of that 8 ribbon cable, he made a fan dipole for 80, 40, 20, and 15, as I remember. You could say that that had no spacing at all. There is no minimum spacing. The minimum spacing is set in your mind depending on how much tuning or calculating you're willing to do. I'll show you what I mean by that. The average guy building a fan dipole, out at the ends, the 40-meter dipole distance to the 80-meter dipole, I'm going to pick a number, or maybe he makes that a 3-foot spacing. And that 3-foot spacing gives him a little bit of capacitive coupling. In other words, the 40-meter dipole in free space. Let me drop it. The 40-meter dipole in free space, let's say, is going to be 67 feet long. And when he mounts it 3 feet away from the 80-meter dipole, the capacitive coupling on the 40-meter will mean that the resonant length of the 40-meter that used to be 67 is now going to be 66 feet, so to speak. As you make that spacing shorter and shorter, the tip of the 40-meter dipole versus the 80-meter dipole, more and more tip capacitance, as if you were putting a top hat capacitor out there. Therefore, the resonant length will have to be shorter, 67, 66, 65, 63, 61 feet. And when you do shorten it and re-resonate it, it'll give you full performance. So, is there a minimum?
Yeah.
It's a function of how much calculating and how much tuning you're willing to do. And obviously, by that guy doing it with ribbon cable, he made the distance essentially zero, but he had to do a fair amount of retuning. So, the 80-meter dipole doesn't even see the 40-meter dipole, no matter what the spacing is. You could make that spacing zero, and the 80-meter wouldn't change at all. So it's just the higher frequency element seeing the tip capacitance to the lower frequency element, tuning them down the lower in frequency, and you're going to shorten them accordingly. And if you had a wide enough tuning range on your antenna tuner, you wouldn't even have to do that. But you and I would like to have the antenna fall like a 1.5 standing wave ratio barefoot before we even use an antenna tuner. So to some degree, there is no minimum because, once again, as you guys have heard me say so often, let me drop. To make an antenna radiate, you will make it resonate first. Burn that into your head. Every antenna that you want to work well must resonate on your favorite frequency first, then it can radiate. Yes, there are kinds of antennas that don't hit resonance, but by normal standards, they're extremely low in efficiency, with the exception of a rhombic where you make it a zillion wavelengths long. That's a real traveling wave antenna. But all of our antennas, you read the right chapter of the book, it'll tell you it's a standing wave structure. That's a fancy way of saying within the writer itself, within the driven element of the antenna, there is a lot of energy bouncing back and forth. A high standing wave ratio inside of the antenna, even though your feed line will see a 1.3-to-1 standing wave ratio, so to speak. And what resonance means is all that bouncing of energy back and forth inside the antenna before it gets radiated. You want all of those bounces to stay co-phase, in step with each other. That's what resonance is. So you can zigzag the wire any old way you want, put loading coils, make it helically wound, zigzag it up and down, left and right, and so on. As long as that structure hits resonance, electronic resonance, at your favorite frequency, it will radiate well. And also bear in mind that we almost always feed a dipole from the center. If you're smart enough, you can feed it anywhere along the length, including the outer tip. You can make a full performance dipole, half wavelength long, feeding it only at the outer tip. The only difference is you got to be a little bit more careful with balancing and impedance matching. Out of the tip, it's 1,500 ohms instead of 70 ohms. But with a simple LC network, that's an easy one. Maybe this helps a little bit, Joe. Was somebody going to add a comment to that?
Yeah, Sheehan. I have a little problem with all of the statements. You have an antenna that is rolled up, so it's a 20-meter dipole, say. And it's, for example, we're not talking about HF antenna, BHF antenna, UHF antenna, just an antenna. And the arms of the antenna are rolled up into the coil. Antenna resonates. And you cut the arm so it resonates at the frequency of 1401 megahertz. And then you take exactly the same antenna, make it resonate at 1401 at the right length of the arms, which will be just a little different. When the arms are untangled straight, the efficiency is going to be different. And to see.
What you said, Wes, is good common sense. It is not accurate. If you look at the appropriate chapter of the Bible of Antenna Engineering, the McGraw-Hill book, 1950, by John Krause, W-H-A-K, the book is called Antennas, and you read his chapter on the infinitesimal dipole. The way you lay out the dipole, the physical length of the dipole, to the nearest half of dB in performance does not matter. Your 20-meter dipole at 14.01 megahertz, where you normally would make it 32 feet long. If you're smart enough, instead of making it 32 feet long, you can roll up portions of it, you can chop drop it off with your side cutters and whatever, and bring it from 32 feet down to 13 feet, for instance. Nothing magic about that number. And if you're smart enough to re-resonate it electronically by using either an antenna tuner with a wide tuning range or putting loading coil at the bottom or put top hat capacitors, when you bring it back into resonance, even though it's physically shorter, a whole lot shorter, good common sense would lead you to believe you've now knocked down the effective capture area and you've hurt the transmitting efficiency. Good common sense, absolutely not true. An extremely short dipole is very high in Q, very narrow in bandwidth. Instead of the signal bouncing back and forth 20 times, it's going to bounce back and forth 200 times. And so now you've got to keep all of those 200 bounces in step. That's part of why it's got a much more narrow bandwidth to it. But still, it recaptures that exact same effective capture area and the exact same antenna efficiency as long as you've used high-efficiency materials. If you could put 100 watts into that antenna, key down for a couple of minutes, turn it off and go out there, and if it's running ice cold, which means it's not just...
repeater, timeout, cancel.
If it runs ice cold, which means it's not dissipating energy, and all the energy you put into it did get radiated, and when you measure the pattern of that very small dipole, it'll have the exact same pattern as the full-length dipole, except that the main lobe will be a little bit fatter. The half dB of decrease in gain is not a half dB of loss. It's just that the dipole figure-eight pattern or the donut pattern in three-dimensional space gets a little bit fatter when you make it shorter. But that shorter physical length dipole, whether it's rolled up, cut up, made unsymmetrical, fed off to one end, no matter what you do, as long as you use low-loss materials, it will have the exact same gain. I know that sounds crazy. I know it's hard to believe the first time you hear it. You start running some experiments, or you read the right chapter of the book, or you use the right modeling program. You will confirm that, in my opinion. And I don't blame you for being skeptical on that one, Wes. You're in good company. A lot of people have that same skepticalness. I wonder if that makes some sense so far, Joe. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, the guy who asked the original question, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Hold on. If an antenna is taken as a device which accepts power from the source and radiates into the space, the ratio of the power radiated into the space to the power accepted from the source is being known as efficiency. So, the ratio of the total power radiated by an antenna to the net power accepted by an antenna from the connected transmitter, the antenna efficiency is a concept of grasp. It is exactly the same as the definition of efficiency for essentially any power conversion device. My understanding is...
So let me interrupt you here, Wes. If you're smart enough to take this antenna, which is the wrong size and laid out in some crazy manner, and if you do a correct job of impedance matching it, it might require a very large range antenna tuner to do it. But if you impedance match it, that means that as far as the transmitter is concerned, it sees a low standing wave ratio. That's a fancy way of saying if you put 100 watts down that transmission line and none of it comes back to the transmitter, 100 watts did get radiated into space. That's nearly 100% efficiency if you've got a good low-loss antenna tuner. The only other thing the antenna can do with it, if you've made the mistake of using lossy materials, it'll convert some of that RF energy into heat. You run a key down with 100 watts for 10 minutes, turn off the transmitter and walk over there, and if it's ice cold, then it's not turning it into heat. So putting it all together, you impedance match it so that none of the power is reflected. Therefore, it's all going in one direction, and if none of it's turned into heat, then by definition, by conservation of energy, it's all being radiated in space because there's no other place that it can go within conservation of energy. Does that make some sense, Wes? N2XJM, K2RIW.
N2XJM. Definitely makes percent space. The radiation efficiency is really what I found or ever published by any antenna manufacturer literature. And I believe there are several reasons for it. The first is that radiation efficiency is very much difficult to measure accurately, and the techniques for experimentally determining radiation efficiency are kind of a subject of ongoing research, that's what they say. And so they barely mention it. But if I have a, you said that the only difference, or the most visible difference, is the bandwidth. So the antenna that has two arms in the form of the coil on the right and left hand side, and does resonate, let me up, will differ to the antenna of the same with the arms spread out to the left and to the right with the bandwidth that it covers. But I take the antenna that has the arms covered, and I maneuver with the capacitance between the windings, with the inductance, with anything that I want, and make the antenna exactly the same bandwidth that the antenna that spread out. Question to you, is it physically possible that I can do it by very much carefully maneuvering with those coils? And the second thing is, what would be then the difference between the antenna in the full length and the antenna of the same that is coiled up?
There's a sort of a yes and a no to your implied question, Wes. An ordinary dipole, for instance, on 80 meters, is around 500 kcy. In other words, you're going to hit 2 to 1 or 3 to 1 standing wave ratio at 3.5 and 4.0 when you've tuned it for 3.75, the center of the band. That's a typical dipole. You start making the dipole much shorter on 80 meters, for instance. Instead of it being 500 kc wide, you can easily get it down to 50 kc wide by normal dipole construction techniques. There are a couple of very elaborate tuning networks that you can add to that dipole that will increase its bandwidth. But it's a fairly elaborate technique. It takes a lot of heroic effort, and the amount of increase in bandwidth you get is not as great as you would like it to be, but it is possible. And you're not violating the laws of physics when you do that. That dipole that's tuned to 3.75, and you're feeding it at 3.5, it is a highly capacitive load. And if you've added an extra network on there of tuning structures, inductors and capacitors set up just right, and maybe with extra feed lines in there acting as resonators, so that now that your extra network creates the right amount of inductive reactance at 3.5 megacycles to correct for the capacitive reactance of the real dipole, then yes, you can make it broader. And you go to the appropriate chapter of the Antenna Handbook by ARRL, you will find some dipole broadbanding techniques. So that is possible. But it's still not violating any laws of physics and the laws of conservation of energy. And let me drop one more time. There's something else I want to say here. And that is that you think that measuring the efficiency, the radiation efficiency of the antenna, is difficult. I say it is not. The beginning of radiation efficiency is where the power out of the transmitter at your frequency you're testing right now, hopefully it's a resonant frequency, the power coming out of the transmitter, if it goes down the transmission line once and you have a very low standing wave ratio, very little of it is reflecting back to the transmitter, you've done that kind of a tuning job with either an antenna tuner somewhere along the system, hopefully low in loss, low loss feed line and so on, if none of the power is reflecting back, you've met the first criteria for high efficiency. The second criteria is run a key down with 100 watts for 10 minutes. If it runs ice cold, you know it's not dissipating any of it in the form of heat. That's the major method by which an antenna can become inefficient as a radiating system. If it takes some of your valuable RF energy and converts it into heat. And the only way it can convert it into heat is that you're going to be able to feel it with your fingers, if you know what I mean. If it runs cold and if it's got no Viswap, then from an electronic point of view, it is nearly 100% efficient. Now, the next step of efficiency is that you and I add a whole bunch of other criteria. We wanted to have a whole lot of gain. We wanted to have a low angle of radiation. We wanted to have exactly horizontal and vertical polarization. We wanted to squirt all the signal out of the horizon. We want none of the surrounding Earth to be absorbing any of the energy and heating up the worm, so to speak. That's the third step in efficiency. Yes, that one is a little bit more difficult to evaluate. But if you meet those first two criteria, you're way downrange as far as creating high efficiency as a transmitter. Make it resonate. Make it impedance match, make it run cold, and you are almost home free, if you know what I mean. You don't have to measure the exact efficiency anymore because you've just about guaranteed it by what...
Repeater, timeout, can't...
You've just about guaranteed it by way of conservation of energy. Let me move on a little bit because I know we can get into this discussion quite a bit deeper. There's more to it, I know, Wes. But that's the first step so far, and we do try to promise people that during the first hour, they're going to get some answers. Joe, I know we got a little off to one side of what you're asking, but you've got a lot more freedom than you know about. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
To make on a subject I brought up earlier on a not previous TechNet about sending antenna elements.
No matter how you bend those elements, Joe, left, right, up, down, zigzag, helical winding, and whatever, as long as you use low resistivity material, high conductive materials, low loss materials, you will have essentially the exact same efficiency. I will admit that you take that 80-meter dipole and you zigzag those elements in some very elaborate manner. I will admit you're going to skew the pattern. Your normal broadside dipole pattern that looks like a donut in three-dimensional space or a figure eight when you make a planar plot of it, that pattern is going to move around in some other way. But still, there's nothing stopping you because your piece of property is not big enough to zigzag it all kinds of ways, to squeeze it onto your property if that's what you want to do, or shorten it and re-resonate it electronically. You got a lot of capability there. Once you understand the principle of operation of a dipole, you almost can't make a bad one, if you know what I mean, Joe. W-2-R-Y-Y for any finals on this. K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Comment on another on something I brought up previously. I'll just let you know that worked out okay, even though I didn't directly do it myself. The subject I brought up was about bending the elements on a Yagi. I give the Yagi to somebody to repair the end of it because it got broken off. When it came down during a windstorm from a couple months ago, the guy repaired the end of it. He did a nice job of re-welding it with aluminum welding. The guy is very good at that kind of stuff. At the same time, the guy did exactly what you suggested, heating up the elements to about 700 some degrees. He put a pipe on the elements, and he was able to straighten out all the elements that were bent, and it looked just about like it was factory made. He did a beautiful job. So straightening them out by bending them with heat does definitely work without fracturing them.
That's darn good information, Joe. Thank you. On top of that, during the time that I was building backyard Yagis on my own ratiometry antenna range, and you can read about that in the February issue 1976 QST magazine, ratiometry and antenna range, a backyard antenna range tuning technique, what I discovered is that the individual directors of a Yagi, you and I want them for physical aesthetic reasons. We want them all to be parallel to each other, parallel to the ground, and so on. And you start skewing them. In other words, you take some of the elements and you tilt them 10 degrees to the right, 10 degrees to the left with reference to being parallel to the ground, and some of them tap you. You start skewing them so that they're not quite parallel to, not perpendicular to the boom anymore. You'd be amazed how far you can get where your eye says that's ugly, and yet you're going to get 98% performance out of that Yagi. They're amazingly forgiving. You may know that I re-patented the Yagi antenna in roughly 2006. Mr. Yagi invented the Yagi in 1928, and I re-patented. You search my name with the patent office, you'll find out I've got a patent on a 915-megacycle, three-element Yagi, where the elements are bent down so that when you look at the Yagi front view, the elements are bent down so that they look like an upside-down U-shape, and the tips are almost bent straight down perpendicular to the ground, and that's an extremely high-performance Yagi. That's not what the patent was about, but in order to make the antenna meet some industrial design criteria, to put lipstick on that pig, as the words that they use, the antenna sitting in the front of this handheld RFID reader, the elements had to be bent down that way to be prettier, and we wanted to make sure that they didn't sacrifice electronic performance in the process of doing that. So if you know what you're doing, let me drop... If you know what you're doing, you'd be amazed how much freedom you got with the way you can skew up the elements. I mean, when I take my Cushcraft Yagi, where the elements are only made out of 16ths of an inch diameter rods, and they get bent up so easily, and if you make every one of them look pretty and bend them all the way back straight, you're going to get metal fatigue and they're going to break off. But if you do the bend back a little bit downrange of where the first bend took place, so that now the element looks like it's got a little bit of an S-curve in it, but you haven't re-stressed the same piece of aluminum so you don't break it off. As homely as that looks, it still gives you full performance. So what makes a Yagi work well is not quite obvious. That Yagi that I re-patented is made out of a flat piece of sheet metal where the elements are about 30 times wider than normal elements. And you would think that the elements are going to be shadowing each other and destroy the Yagi performance. It is the opposite. The performance increased. The efficiency increased. The bandwidth increased. And then not only do we make them very wide out of sheet metal, we put holes in them so that the injection molding rubber would have a way of grabbing through the middle of each of the elements in order to hold everything together. So as I said, what I think I'm going to do next TechNet is I'll tell you guys the patent number. So you go and look at the picture of this thing and you're going to say, gee, that doesn't look like a Yagi. It does have a very high performance. So you'd be amazed how forgiving they are, Joe. And so all of the heating and bending to make it absolutely straight. For aesthetic reasons, it gave you and your buddy a good, warm, fuzzy feeling for doing it. You didn't have to go that far, if you know what I mean. Okay, let's see what Jim's got to say. KD2BHY. KQRIW. Go right ahead, Jim, and how's that tuna fish can transmitter of yours coming along? You got it, Jim.
Yeah, thanks. Actually, my question today was about that. I was looking at it today, and I just needed a... It's not working, but I figured I'd ask you a few questions about it. Is that all right?
That's what we're here for, Jim. Wait for the beeps and go right ahead.
So I have it right here, and I have a multimeter, and I was just wondering, are there any basic tests that I could do with the multimeter and the transmitter to find out what could be wrong?
If I remember correctly, Jim, what you're building is a crystal-controlled Morse code transmitter in a small container. In the early days, we used to call that a tuna fish can transmitter. And so I think it's transistorized, but maybe it's got a tube. It doesn't matter. Your first criteria to worry about is it oscillating? You've got a crystal, you've got a tube, and the tube is supposed to be doing, or transmitter, transistor, and it's supposed to be doing transmitting. But until the oscillator with the crystal breaks into oscillation, nothing's going to come out. And so how do you test whether or not it's oscillating? Your receiver that's in the same room with you should be able to pick up the signal. That's criteria number one. And the frequency that's marked on the crystal, that's the first place where you're going to tune your receiver to start listening for it, so to speak. So do you hear it is the first criteria. If not, find out what is not resonating and why it's not breaking into oscillation. Another step you can do is that almost every oscillating circuit has got resistors somewhere. It's got resistors that give you the bias current for the base, so to speak. And when you measure the voltage across those resistors, is it what it's supposed to be? Is the voltage being applied correctly? By using your digital voltmeter, your volt-ohm-milliammeter, in series with the battery, you can find out how much current it's drawing. Is it drawing the right amount of current? So, step by step, is it drawing the right current? Are the right voltages present in the right places? Is it breaking into oscillation? Can you hear it on the receiver? These are some of the tests that you're going to want to do. And maybe you're going to want to have somebody in the room with you to help you with the suggestions. That would make it go faster, but even without somebody to help you, you can't do a heck of a lot of damage on a thing like this. If at worst you blow out the transistor because you drop a screwdriver.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
If you drop a screwdriver in there at the wrong time and create a short circuit and blow out the transistor, so to speak, it probably is a $1 item, and it's not the end of the world. So don't be worried about doing the testing. And usually the kind of a transmitter that I think you're building is reasonably safe. In other words, standing nearby, putting your fingers in it, if it's transistorized, is reasonably safe. I'll admit that if it's a tube-type transmitter running on 300 volts, you got to be a heck of a lot more careful. As you can tell, I've forgotten the exact transmitter you're building, so give us a little more information, Jim. KD2BHY, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
It's a it has one transistor, one crystal, and CW. I'm using a 9-volt battery to power it, so I don't really think anything can go wrong.
You're absolutely right. So one transistor, a 9-volt battery, all that's safe as all hell. No matter how that's operating, you can put your fingers in there, and with rare exception, you're not going to get in trouble. Now, since you said it's not working, I think that means that you've listened on your receiver, and you don't hear it. And most transmitters have a tuning control somewhere. There's a variable capacitor somewhere, usually, that as you sweep through that capacitance range, if the coil is wound correctly and the capacitor is properly hooked up, somewhere in the sweeping of that capacitor, it's supposed to break into oscillation, assuming the crystal is a good crystal. There's a slim possibility you've got a bad crystal that's determining the frequency, in which case if somebody will volunteer to give you another one, you can do a substitution there and make sure. And even if the novice portion of the band maybe is what you're seeking, 7.15 megacycles is the crystal you've got, and it's suspicious, and somebody loaned you a crystal for 7.05, the general portion or the advanced portion of the band, just to try it out to make sure the oscillator is running, you could go out of band, so to speak, when you're doing testing into a dummy load in the shack. You don't want to get on the air and start calling CQ on the wrong frequencies if you don't have that license requirement yet. So step by step, is it drawing the right current? Is the 9-volt battery still putting out 9 volts? I believe you own a volt-ohm milliammeter. I believe you might even have a digital voltmeter. So there's various ways that measuring currents and voltages will give you a hint. But the circuitry around that crystal oscillator, including the transistor, must hit the resonant frequency in order for the whole circuit to break into oscillation so that it can do a transmitting job. I wonder if you've made any of those measurements so far. I wonder if you do own a volt-ohm milliammeter or a digital voltmeter.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Over to you, Jim. KQRIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, I have a digital multimeter. I haven't done any measurements yet, and instead of a receiver, I have, I could use my receiver, but I have, right now I have a field strength meter with a field strength.
A field strength meter, usually if it's used correctly, nearby, will jump up and show you an indication when you press down the key to transmit, when you hit resonance, when you hit oscillation. The receiver also should really start showing some action if the receiver is tuned to the right frequency. So as you tune that variable capacitor and hit oscillation, the current drain from the 9-volt battery will change. The voltage generated across the transistor, the AC voltage, will change. You've got to be a little bit careful on that one. In the case of a transmitter that's on, let me pick a number, 7 megahertz, you can't use the AC voltage scale of the average volt-ohm milliammeter or DC voltmeter. The AC scale on those meters is made to operate on 60 hertz, 400 hertz, and maybe a couple of kilohertz. But by the time you get up to 7 megacycles, 7 megahertz, the AC scale on those meters no longer is rated to go that high. It can't give you a reliable indication. So the field strength meter is one way, but just sensing the fact that the current changes when you tune through resonance is a very strong clue. And the fact that you do or don't hear it on your receiver is a strong clue. After you do a bunch of these experiments, if you still don't hit any success, guarantee there's a number of guys out there like Andy and me and Eric and whatever who will volunteer to look over your shoulder, see what you're doing, and make some suggestions. So you got a lot of ways to go here. So don't worry about damaging anything. There's no real expensive parts there. Start making measurements of voltages and currents to begin with. Back to you, Jim. KD2BHY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
A comment, Dick.
Yeah, stand by, Jim. Go ahead, John.
Dick, I think if James measures battery voltage and leave that meter lead on the negative, make sure he has collector voltage. See if he has the 7/10, if it's an NPN, and a silicon transistor. Just the basics to make sure that he's got the wiring right. Then he can worry about the best way is with a receiver, not a voltmeter, to check that. But I'm sure he could go step by step with those simple measurements and find exactly where the problem is. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I'm going to make a couple of guesses here, Jim. In a situation like this, when you're brand new to the hobby, it's fairly easy to wire the transistor backwards. Emitter, base, and collector might not be wired into the right place. It's very easy to reverse those. Is it an NPN transistor instead of a PNP transistor that was required by the schematic diagram? Did you make a substitution? If it asked for a 2N3541, so to speak, did you put in something else that you think is equivalent? Many times that works like a charm. Occasionally that gives you a little bit of grief. On most transistors, if you put the voltmeter between the emitter and the base, and you want to find out is it at least getting the right kind of forward bias, the emitter and base should be about 2 or 3 tenths of a volt apart if it's a germanium transistor, and something like 7 tenths of a volt apart if it's a silicon transistor between emitter and base. Between emitter and collector, you should see most of the 9 volts, 8 or so volts, so to speak, between emitter and collector. So voltmeter tests in various places, current tests, and one real, if you've got a real good digital voltmeter, just leaving the digital voltmeter connected across the 9-volt battery will give you a very interesting indication. As you tune through resonance and the transmitter draws a different amount of current, either the current's going to go up or the current's going to go down, but there's a different amount of current. Every battery has a little bit of voltage drop depending on the current that you draw. You'll suddenly see on your digital voltmeter some of the least, lowest emitter bits, you know what I mean? The right-hand numbers will start changing. So that's a poor man's way of measuring current. But using a volt ohm milliammeter, it...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Using a volt ohm milliammeter in the ampere mode, which means you've got to move the red wire. Almost all volt ohm milliammeters, when you measure current instead of voltage, you leave the black wire plugged into the meter at the same place, but the red wire's got to move. And so when you put that volt ohm milliammeter in the current mode and put it with clip leads in series with the 9-volt battery, where you continuously monitor the current, that's going to give you some strong indication. So there's a whole bunch of tests that you can make along these lines, Jim. Make yourself a notebook page in where you write down what you saw during each of these measurements. Bring those measurements back to us, and that's going to give us a lot of hints. And even if it doesn't work, if you do all of this experimenting, drop the word, and there's a number of people who will come and look over your shoulder and say, hey, if you do this, it's going to get better. And I guess you've already double-checked the schematic diagram versus your wiring. And back to you, Jim. KD2BHY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I did that. I think everything was right. I think I may have just wired something wrong or done something like that. But thanks. That was really helpful, and I'm gonna see if I can do some of these tests. Thanks so much.
I do recommend you get yourself one of those black and white speckled notebooks and draw a schematic diagram on the first page. And on your drawn schematic diagram, maybe you're going to draw the schematic in pencil, and then with a red pencil, you write down the voltages that you measure in various positions. From here to here, you measure that number of volts. And with the ohm meter, with the ammeter, you measure this number of amps when you made this change, and so on. So by the time you write yourself some diagrams, write down some good notes, make the measurements, and record them, that's going to be a data set. It's going to be a spreadsheet, so to speak, that a smart person looking at that spreadsheet, you take a photograph of it, and you mail the schematic diagram to me, you mail that spreadsheet to me with those measurements, and you take a picture and you send it to my email address, and you let me or Andy or Eric or anyone else who is supposedly smart enough look at that. You're going to get a whole lot of further hints. So good luck with that, Jim. Take that data and present it to those people, and you're going to get results. Just a matter of time. And it's a very learning experience, as you can tell. To a small degree, you should be happy it didn't work right off the bat, because you're going to be learning troubleshooting techniques. Raise the next guy on the list, KC2, Mike Yankee. How's things going with you, Ray? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Roger that. How you doing, Dick? I just thought I just wanted to mention, I do have a question, but I wanted to mention first, James's circuit, he's building it off the one I built. If you go to my QRZ page, KC2MMY, there's a link to the circuit if you wanted to look at it. And I just want to make sure that James is not, people that when they first start, when they're wiring, they don't know how to read the schematic, and he might be shorting everything together. You only connect the dots there, James. Anything that lines that cross that don't have a dot don't get connected. Just want to let you know that.
And one other thing, Ray, before you start, on your QIZ.com photograph there, very cute little dog. What's his name? I go ahead with the question. You got it, Ray.
Roger, that was jalapeno. It was a puppy I had, and I sold him a while back. Okay, my question was, if I can remember it all, when would you use a 4-to-1 balun versus a 1-to-1 balun? Then on what side is the 4 considered, the antenna side or the transmission line side? And what's the situation with using different transmission lines, coax versus 300 ohm twin leads? So how does that all work, and how do I know what to use? Over, back to you.
I think I know where you're going here, Ray. And if you don't have some experience with balance, you think that there's a hidden piece of information that the 4-to-1 balance, this must be the input and that must be the output, and you can't use it backwards. Very similar to in the case of a power transformer. If I've got a power transformer in the old days where the primary's got 120 volts, 60 cycle AC on it, the secondary is a 6.3 volt output winding, which used to go to the filaments of the tubes. Ordinarily, the 120 volts is the input and the 6.3 volts is the output. Well, every so often you get a smart guy who says, I need a isolation transformer. He takes a pair of those transformers, hooks them together where he puts 120 volts on the primary, and 6.3 volts comes out of the secondary of transformer number one. He takes the 6.3 volts out of the first transformer, plugs it into the 6.3 volt winding of the second transformer. He's using that one backwards, and now he gets 120 volts out of that second transformer's primary winding. His reason for doing that is he wanted to build a 1-to-1 isolation transformer. He wanted a transformer to make sure he doesn't have a shocking potential in the work he's doing at the bench. And so as long as he's not drawing a whole lot of wattage, two transformers hooked together back-to-back like that works like a charm. By the same token, that 4-to-1 balun of yours, if you happen to have 300-ohm twin lead, and you connected the 300-ohm twin lead transmission line to the 4-to-1 input impedance, the high impedance of the 4-to-1, and it takes the 300, divides it by 4, and you get something like 75, and now it's not exactly 75, but it's in that ballpark, and now you feed a piece of 75-ohm coax with that. That would be an impedance-matching device between those two. So what's called balun, in most cases, it's really a impedance...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
A Balun that's not one-to-one is usually doing two things for you simultaneously, stepping up or stepping down the voltage, which really is stepping up or stepping down the impedance. That's the first thing that a non-one-to-one Balun is doing. And the second thing is it's usually isolating things from ground. A good Balun, properly used, will isolate things from ground. By that I mean, in the case of 50-ohm coax cable, if that's what you decided to use to feed your dipole antenna, and temporarily you can do this, where you take the shield of the coax cable and feed it to the left side of the dipole, take the center conductor of the coax cable and feed it to the right side of the dipole. It's not the best way to do it, but it does work in a pinch. The only thing that's wrong with that is that the dipole itself tries to balance itself in space. You think the center conductor has got all the voltage. You think the shield of the coax cable has none of the voltage. Therefore, you think you're feeding only the right side of the dipole. Well, the dipole will rebalance things for you. And the bottom line of that is that you will be generating voltage on the left side of the dipole. That side is connected to the coax cable, to the shield, and you will be feeding RF energy back down the shield, which in some cases can give you some grief if that coax cable runs alongside of the apartment that your neighbor's apartment in your particular building and gives them television interference. That's one way it can give you some grief. Let me drop. In that particular case, if you put a one-to-one Balun at the end of the transmission line, the coax cable, and the output of that you fed to the left side and the right side of the dipole, you wouldn't be getting that phenomenon. So a Balun is used for isolating things from ground, the shield in that particular case, and giving you an impedance match depending on how high or low is the impedance of your transmission line or your particular antenna. Now, what's the best kind of transmission line? Let me drop. What's the best kind of transmission line is a little bit like saying, what's the best kind of wife I can marry? Should it be a blonde, a brunette, or a redhead? Should she be tall or short, wide or narrow? I mean, it's a matter of what to you is the best way, if you know what I mean. There are guys who just love open wire cable, open wire feed line, 600 ohm or 300 ohm open wire cable. There are guys who just love coax cable. Each has its advantage. The coax cable, you can run it alongside of ductwork. You can bend it around anything you want. You can feed it alongside of anything in the shack, going through the wall, outside, and it's extremely non-vulnerable. Twin lead has lower loss. Open wire feed line has lower loss. That's the good news. But you got to obey a whole bunch of brand new rules. You can't put tacks in the middle of it. You can't lay it up against the ductwork of the house, against sheet metal. You can't lay it against the tower leg without standoff insulators. It gives you lower loss, but you got to be more careful. And in the old days, we used to worry about rain sitting on the twin lead and giving you some extra loss. So what's the best transmission line? It's the one you own that's got low enough loss to deliver most of the RF energy to your particular antenna, and it's long enough to go from the shack to the antenna. So, and many of us will start off with coax cable, use twin lead downrange, go back to another kind of coax cable later. Each cable, each antenna, each altitude you mount these things, they've all got their advantages and disadvantages. There is no best one. It's depending on what you want to do, what you like to do, what you understand, what you feel familiar with, which one of them gives you a warm, fuzzy feeling. Sort of like saying, should I buy a Kenwood, an ICOM, or a Yaesu? The answer is yes. If you're at a flea market and one of them is being sold at, sold used at a real good price, the exact brand name usually doesn't matter. My attitude when it comes to buying a piece of used equipment, Ray, is that by way of my friendship with Andy, Eric, Glenn, John, and whatever, and my own experience, I know that if I buy a used rig, and I don't care if the front panel is dented, I don't care if it's got scratches, I don't care if it's been thrown down a flight of stairs, if most of the parts are in there and they haven't been cannibalized, therefore it's got the capability of being a transmitter. And therefore, fixing it is just a matter of applying the right energy to find out where the error was. Maybe the guy burned out the front end by having another transmitter in the shack